We are in 2 Corinthians this morning, chapter 12. Next week we will begin Matthew. Next Sunday evening we'll have communion. I'm going to read the first 10 verses. 2 Corinthians chapter 12 begins by saying, "It is not expedient for me, doubtless, to glory. I will come to visions and revelations of the Lord. I knew a man in Christ about 14 years ago. And whether he was in the body, I cannot tell, or whether they're out of the body, I cannot." Doesn't know whether he was dead or alive is what he's saying. "God knoweth. Such a one was caught up to the third heaven. And I knew such a man, whether in the body or out of the body, I cannot tell, God knows, how that he was caught up unto paradise, and heard unspeakable words, which it is not lawful for a man to utter. Of such a one will I glory. Yet of myself I will not glory, but in my infirmities. For though I would desire to glory, I should not be a fool." What he's saying here is, even if I do boast about these things, I won't be doing it as a fool, because everything I'm telling you is true. Well, that's what he's saying. King James makes it a little hard to understand here. Verse 6, "For though I would desire to glory, I shall not be a fool, for I will say the truth. But now I forbear, lest any man should think of me above that which he seeth me to be, or he heareth of me. Now lest I should be exalted above measure," now Paul is identifying the man as himself, "lest I should be exalted above measure through the abundance of revelations, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure. For this thing I besought the Lord three times, that it might depart from me. And he said unto me, My grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. And therefore I take pleasure in mine infirmities." The guy's in a different plateau than I'm on, I have to be honest. "Therefore I take pleasure in mine infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then am I strong." So Paul starts to describe to us this work of grace in his life that he says is a painful work of grace. And sometimes God's grace does hurt, but he puts it into focus for us. He is defending himself against those who say that they were apostles, false apostles. And Paul is basically saying, you've forced me again to boast, to share with you things that have happened to me. If you think these guys are great, he goes through, I've been scourged five times, I've been beaten with rods three times, I've been stoned and left for dead once, I've been a night and a day in the deep, shipwrecked three times, this and that, you know, cold, nakedness, peril, the sword, fasting. And by the way, this is all by the 19th chapter of Acts. When we read of Paul's shipwreck, and all that's after this. So he was shipwrecked at least four times. He's saying by the 19th chapter of the book of Acts, all this stuff in chapter 11 has already taken place in his life, which is remarkable. Doesn't sound like, you know, you read that and you think, who wants to be in the ministry, you know? And now he says, let's move on. He said, these guys think they're great. I've been through all this stuff. He says, let's move on to revelations and to visions. Now, first of all, I like to say I am always suspicious when someone has had visions and revelations and they're bragging about them. Paul evidently had kept this under wraps for 14 years and hadn't really told anybody. And I think when you have these kind of things happen to you, you don't talk about them a whole lot. Perhaps they may come up as the Lord leads, as circumstances are suited to talk about them. But it seems to me when they're genuine, when something really happens like this, it's not something really that's talked about that much. So I'm very suspicious anytime anybody has a set of revelations or visions and is selling the tapes. Again, the last guy in the area, the guy that was a killer to me was the guy that was in heaven for, I forget. So he must have used seven, because that's a spiritual number. 7 days and nights. My daughter, who was then 8 years old, looked at it and said, "Daddy, I thought Revelation said there's no night in heaven." I said, "Very good. Very good. He was in the wrong city somewhere, wherever it was." And again, the set of tapes was $60. You know, I say, "Lord, if you bring the guy all the way to heaven and bring us this news, make it affordable. Nobody can, you know, nobody's ever going to find out for $60, you know." So it's, when I hear of anybody that's been there, revelations, visions, I think you would be smart, too, to be very suspicious, first of all. But Paul is even embarrassed in the way he brings this out. He doesn't identify himself immediately, but he says whether this person, and identifying himself finally, was dead or alive, I can't even tell. Now, we know it was him because he finally starts to talk about himself in the first person. He tells us what this guy saw was unspeakable, was unlawful to be uttered, so it had to be him or he couldn't have found out about it. He says he doesn't know whether he's in or out of the body. This had to be his own experience for him to realize, you know, to go through that. So he was caught up, it seems, to the third heaven. And again, that is the atmospheric heaven would be the first heaven. Outer space would be the second heaven, the stellar heavens. And the Bible speaks of a place that where the kingdom of God, the throne of God, is established as the third heaven. There is a place beyond the heavens the way we understand them, where heaven, as the Bible speaks of it, is, where the throne of God is. You know, and I think it speaks in terms of up and down, so we'll understand. Jesus, though, said it was in our midst. How far away and how close it is certainly something that we can debate about. We do know. In Chronicles, it tells us, "Of my people who are called by my name would humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I would hear from heaven." So wherever it is, he can hear us. We don't have to scream. Wherever it is, he's able to hear us. We also know, as we look at the life of Elijah, as God spoke to him, Elijah said, the tone of his ministry was calling down fire from heaven, the display of power and so forth. He said when God came to speak to him, the voice of God wasn't in the fire, wasn't in the earthquake, it wasn't in the hurricane, but behold, a still small voice, as God spoke to Elijah. And it's the same way he speaks to us. All of us know that still small voice. We may identify it differently. We may describe it differently. I'm sure God customizes it for us because we're all different. But somehow, each of us know when God is prodding us or speaking to us. So wherever heaven is, it's close enough so actually that we can hear. And we can sense when God is telling us something. Well, Paul says he was actually taken to that place. Now, that's beyond visions. We know he had visions. When he was saved on the road to Damascus, Jesus Christ appeared to him there. He tells us in another place, as he's describing that experience, that he had a vision of a man named Ananias who would come and minister to him. We know that Paul the Apostle saw the vision of the man from Macedonia saying, "Come over this way." We know Jesus appeared to him when he was in Jerusalem in the cell. We know that when he was in a storm on the ocean, an angel appeared to him there. Paul was a guy who had a number of visions. But now this revelation, this thing he's talking about, is an incredible, incredible thing. Because he was actually taken to, it seems, the third heaven. He was actually taken into paradise. Now, Jesus used this phrase when he said to the thief on the cross next to him, "Today you'll be with me in paradise." It's used one other time in the New Testament in Revelation chapter 2 when there's a promise to the overcomer that he'll be able to eat of the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. So this description of paradise is a place in the midst of heaven and where there's the city and the park and so forth. Paul was taken there. And for 14 years, he kept his mouth shut. He said, "You know, it's unlawful to speak the other." And what he's saying is it would be a crime to try to describe what I saw and heard there. And again, I'm convinced that's why God gave the revelation on Patmos to John the Apostle. Because if he'd given it to Paul, Paul would have just said, "It's a crime to try to say." He wouldn't have wrote anything. John was the mystic. John was the one inclined. John was the perfect one to record that. But you have to realize, as we read this here, there is no other record of any apostle to this date ever experiencing this. There is no record anywhere in the Bible, I believe, of any man going to the third heaven and coming back again. Enoch went but didn't come back. Paul probably had the most unique experience since Adam walked with God in paradise. And remember, this is years before John the Apostle saw it on the Isle of Patmos. So to date, no one has experienced what Paul has experienced in this unique way. To go there and to see these things. He says, I don't even know whether I was dead or alive. He said the experience was so incredible. Now he's going to go on to describe to us then this thorn in the flesh that God gave him, this humbling that God brought into his life then. And he said that humbling took place so that I wouldn't be puffed up about the revelation that I had. Now, I am convinced of this. Some think, I am personally convinced that, and I may be wrong, so you form your own opinion, that this took place at Lystra, because Paul does mention in the chapter before this being stoned and left for dead once, and that was evidently miraculous because they drugged Paul out of the city as they would do with the body of a dead stranger and throw him on the trash heap. And it says Paul stood up and went back into the city. We don't know whether he said more stones, you're not done, whatever he said. But I believe that this experience he's describing here is the experience that fueled his personal zeal for Christ for the rest of his life. Because this was a guy that was not afraid to drown. He was not afraid to get whipped. He was not afraid of lions. He wasn't afraid of anything. Because he was looking forward to one of those things working and getting him out of here. And to me, I believe that this experience he's describing is, you know, God gave it to him because he knew that Paul would need this kind of drive to accomplish and get through the things that God would set ahead of him. And yet at the same time, God knew that Paul would sin. Paul was not enough of a man to handle the revelations that God gave him, and that if God did not intervene, that Paul's pride would take him down and he would never be the man God wanted him to be. Now that's amazing. And I think, you know, sometimes we think, Lord, I want a revelation. I'd love to see this. Lord, take me on deeper. Let me see an angel. Let me, you know, and I think, do we really consider the price or the cost of these kind of things taking place in our life? And again, I think in my own experience, which obviously is shallow compared to many people here in the church, and particularly in regards to Paul, the things I appreciate most now about the freedom I have to study God's Word and the beauty of a simple personal relationship with Christ, the things I appreciate most about Jesus are the things that I paid the most in heartache and pain and stupidity to learn. And that leaves me standing here this morning thinking, gee, if he wants to take me onward to deeper water, I might just stay right here. You know, his sovereignty is a great comfort to me because it overrides my penchant to make mistakes and to sin. It overrides my weakness. It overrides my own ability to lose my own salvation if I was involved at all. God's sovereignty is a great comfort to me because it's through that that he'll present me faultless before his throne in glory with exceeding joy. But on the other hand, his sovereignty is also the thing that it seems reserves the right to touch my health or to touch one of my children or to do something in my life that will take me deeper. Because I'm a no-hassle kind of guy. You know, I if I could write out the menu, we just kind of cruise along and wait for the rapture to happen. But for all I know, for all of us, he may want to continue to teach us things and cause us to mature until that takes place. And when I look at Paul, you know, the remarkable thing is, and because God knew Paul better than Paul knew Paul, God actually understood that if he did not bring into Paul's life this affliction, which was, Paul tells, directly related to the revelations he had, that Paul would have gotten puffed up and pride may have set him on the shelf or removed him from the ministry or made he would never have accomplished the things that he would have accomplished. So I want you to notice one thing. As we look at this thorn in the flesh, whatever it is, and we don't know what it is, whatever it is not God's chastening. God is not chastening Paul for sin. God is not punishing Paul with this thorn in the flesh, whatever this disease or whatever it was that was bothering him. It's not because Paul lacked faith or had sin in his life. And you see, that's important for you to understand because, again, there's a whole teaching in the church today that if you're sick, it's because there's a lack of faith in your life or it's because there's sin in your life. And that is not biblical. In fact, in Galatians 1, and some scholars think Paul's talking about his eye problem, in Galatians 1 and 2, he talks there about the Galatians. He said, you would have given me your eyes if it were possible. He talks how he came there in infirmity. And the Greek doesn't say, despite the fact I was sick, I came to Galatia, and it was through that the church was given birth to. He said, it was because of my sickness that I ended up in Galatia and these churches were born. When Paul looks back at that illness, he recognizes the hand of God and says it was God's instrument that brought me to this area that these churches would be born. He used it in my life for that purpose. Epaphras was left behind sick, and Paul was a guy that did miracles, that saw people healed. Paul didn't say to Epaphras, well, you must be in sin, you must lie. He said, pray for him. He said to Timothy, drink a little wine for your stomach. I know you've all got bad stomachs. He said, drink a little wine for your stomach and you're off in infirmity. Because, there was no water filtration system in those days. And everybody, you have Herod's revenge as you traveled around that part of the world and stuff. Any of those people that promote that kind of theology just need to read the book of Job, because it's the story of the entire book of Job. A godly man without sin. We see the whole stage set in the beginning of Job. He is inflicted. Satan is at work. We see the illness. We see the things that take place. All through, his counselors are saying it's because there's sin in your life. It's because you've done something against God. It's because of this. And the whole thing is, all the way through the book, it's showing us that's nonsense. It has nothing to do with any of that. Job never gets the question answered. Why? What he gets answered is, hey, I put the clouds where they are. I did this. I did this to the unicorn. I called down the lightning. I set the heavens in their place. The basic answer he got from God was, Job, I know what I'm doing. And Job said, you know what you're doing. Now, Paul is basically coming to that conclusion here. God has given Paul a thorn in the flesh that Paul would not develop a thorn within. It's interesting. Frank Enemy, a book last week, I'm reading through it. Maybe you've read it. A Tale of Three Kings, which is a story of David and Saul and Absalom. And the author makes an interesting point. He said, David is afflicted by Saul. God allows that so that he's afflicted with the Saul without, so that the Saul within doesn't form. In other words, the previous Saul didn't have a Saul to hassle him to death. And what he's saying is all of us are like King Saul. All of us have the potential to be puffed up with pride, turn away from God, be mean to other people, throw spears at them, yell at them. He said, but with David, God loved David so much, he allowed Saul there so that Saul would never form within. And I think it's the same thing we see here with Paul. God is bringing on purpose this crisis to Paul's life so that Paul would not be puffed up with pride and ruined for the rest of his life, so that this vision would fuel the fire. God has taken him through a deep experience and revealed things about himself to Paul, and that would drive Paul. But on the other side of the coin is, with what he understands, there's always then the danger he'd be tempted to be puffed up with pride. So God not only has to give him the fuel for the fire, but then he has to contain it and humble Paul along the way. And I think it's the same process with all of us as we look at it. So it tells us here, verse 7, that he's given this to Paul, lest I should be exalted above measure, and Paul's indicating that he would have been, through the abundance of the revelations, there was given to me, and he didn't view it that way in the beginning, a thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I should be exalted, there it is again, above measure. For this thing I besought the Lord three times that it might depart from me. Now, as we look at that, Paul's initial reaction to it, and we're assuming, it's been over a 14-year period, we're assuming the problem started when the revelation came. Shortly after, in fact, the language indicates when he says, God said unto me, my greatest vision, it's God hath said unto me. And the way it's written out, it could have spanned the whole time. And not only that, it's God hath said and is presently saying. The idea is it rung in Paul's ears for the rest of his life. And God did not answer Paul's prayer the way Paul wanted God to answer his prayer. What he said was, my grace is sufficient for thee. That isn't what Paul wanted to hear. You know, I would have said, well, gee, if you just bail me out, you can give your grace to somebody else. I wouldn't need it so much. Paul says that there was given him a thorn in the flesh. Now, I don't know what it was, and I'm glad that it's not identified, and scholars go back and forth whether it's malaria or an eye problem or an injury that he received when he was stoned at Lystra. I'm glad we don't know exactly what it is, because that way all of us can relate. If we knew for sure it was an eye problem, then all of us with different problems than eye problems, we wouldn't feel included. This way, Paul has something, a thorn in the flesh, evidently physical, bothering him, the messenger from Satan to buffet him. We're not sure if that was the same thing or a complimentary gift given with the first, which it goes that way. You know, if you're suffering, if there's something wrong, the messenger of Satan is always there to say, well, if God loves you, why is this happening? You know, if he's God is so wonderful, why is it, you know, you did something. You sinned against your great aunt before you were born, and you have to do this. You know, I mean, you know, it gives all kinds of rise to things in the church that become so complicated. You know, your ancestor did this, or here is this messenger from Satan saying to Paul, if you're his apostle, why is he allowing this happen? If you just think what you could accomplish if it wasn't for this. Just think how free you could be if you didn't have this infirmity. You know, maybe you're not saved. Maybe that's why this is happening in your life. Maybe you need to spend more time in prayer. God is not happy with you. Maybe you're reprobate. Maybe you're somewhere in Hebrews 6 or 10. You know, whatever it is, that's the way the enemy adds to its insult to injury when these kind of things come. Whether the thorn was the messenger, we're not sure, but we know if, with the thorn, certainly the messenger comes. He comes to us too. The enemy hassles us in the same way. And I think that every one of us has at least one thorn we can identify. You know, if only I could get this better job, or if only I could make more money, then this would happen, or if only my spouse was more committed to Christ, or if only this person would ask me to marry them, or if only, you know, my boss would die, or if only, you know, whatever. Everybody has at least one, maybe more, if onlys in their lives, and we think, well, if only I would get healed, if only my kid had his health, if only this, you know, we all have our if onlys, and we think if they would just move out of the way, then imagine what, if God, if you would just cooperate, we could accomplish such marvelous things. And you can pick whether you want to work with plan A, B, or C here. I'll give you a multiple choice. Well, see, that's, I believe, what happened to Paul. When this first came to him, Paul didn't say in the beginning, this was a thorn, a gift from God given to me. When it first came, he prayed to get away from it. Get this out of here, Lord. And evidently three times over a period of years, he prayed God, he besought the Lord twice that it might depart. No doubt with fasting, seeking God, remove this from me, seeing it as a hindrance, seeing it as a monkey wrench that was thrown into the works, seeing it as something that was ruining his ministry or his plan for life or his happiness or his well-being or his potential. And yet along that way, you know, he reacted the same way that I would react. Along the way, he begins hearing this constant voice from God, my grace is sufficient for thee. That is not what I would want to hear. I would want to hear, okay, next Tuesday it'll be gone. I mean, if God gave me the choice, Joe, I'll catch you up to heaven, let you see the third heaven now. It's just because of your problem with pride, when I bring you back, I'm going to have to give you the thorn and the messenger. What do you say? I'd say, no, I'll wait. I'll wait. I'll be there someday anyway. I'll wait. Wouldn't you? But God knows where Paul's going to be next week. God knows where Paul's going to be next year. God is able to prescribe the proper medicine because he is the God who is and was and is to come. He's already waiting for us in next week's problems. You know, I mean, I sit at home with my kids and I look at them and there are certain things I want for their lives. Now, I like to see them have fun. You know, we were away at a hotel this week, the Thursday and Friday. I love to see them in the pool. You know, I love to see them waste all my money in video games. You know, I love to see them having a great time. I love to see them blessed. But then there are other things where I'm concerned about them because I love them that I enforce in their lives that they don't understand yet. They're, you know, I know that a chocolate chip cookie diet will kill them and that they have to learn to eat string beans or something with substance, you know. And they'll sit at the table, you know, put it in their mouth and quick, the lemonade, you know, to wash it down. You know, you swallow one pea, you know, with a, it takes a quart of lemonade to get, and you see them. And if you don't give them something to drink, they're like, and if you throw up, I'll kill you, you know. You know, you got, you know, kids are so funny. And you see, I have all these other concerns because I know them better than they know themselves. I know, you know, they're going to be growing, they're going to be maturing. I have concerns that sexual promiscuity is not going to take them down. I have concerns that they're not going to turn to drugs. I have concerns that the same faith I have is really their own, that they're not just saying the words for me and my wife, but in fact, they really have a personal relationship with Christ, that they're really born again. There's certain things I'm enforcing on them because I know that it will keep them down the road, physically for their health, mentally, spiritually, that they don't appreciate so much right now. Well, I'm sure, because God says he loves us more than our kids, we love our own kids, that he's doing certain things in our lives now because he knows where we're going to be next week, where we're going to be next year, and he's doing those things for our benefit, though sometimes grace hurts. And when you and I think of grace, especially when we're first saved, we think what grace is that's what he gives us when we sin after we get saved. Oh, I blew it. I need some grace today. Cover that up. It's like concrete patch mix or something, you know. As we go on, we learn that it's all grace, man. It's grace from beginning to end. I think of Daniel in the palace when Belshazzar takes over, Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, and he's mocking the God of Israel, and they're drinking out of the cups of gold and silver, and the handwriting comes on the wall, and they call Daniel in to interpret. He said, you know, the problem is here, Belshazzar, you refuse to give glory to the God in whose hand your breath is. And the Bible teaches that our next breath is in his. It's his grace that we draw the next breath and don't have a heart attack, that we live onward. Paul really capsulizes it in Titus when he says it's the grace of God. The grace of God hath drawn us to salvation, has brought us to salvation. It's teaching us that living in this present world, we should deny ungodly lust, looking forward to the coming of our blessed Lord, you know, of the blessed Lord, even Jesus Christ. So Paul says that grace brought us in the first place, saved us. Grace is keeping us today, teaching us to deny the ungodly lust that every single one of us have within inside of us and that the world draws on. And grace is the only thing that teaches us to look forward to the coming of the kingdom. You see, if it wasn't for God's grace, I would not look forward to the coming of Jesus Christ. I would tremble in fear because I know I'm a no good wretch, saved by his grace. But because of his grace, because he's washed me and cleansed me, I can therefore look forward even to his return, breaking into this time-space world and setting up his kingdom. So it's grace all the way through, from beginning to end. And Paul said as time went on, he began to see in this experience that the thorn and the messenger and the denied prayer were all a gift, that they were all working in concert to take the depth and the beauty of the things God had revealed to him and put a governor on them so that he might fulfill God's purposes and be the man that God wanted him to be, instead of being puffed up with pride and being immature about the things God has showed him. He says, therefore I've learned that, and God has told me that in my weakness his strength is made perfect. So he says, I rather glory in my infirmities. Oh, great. You know, another shipwreck. Boy, oh, it's going to be great to see how God keeps the sharks away and how he does this. You know, oh, stoning, good. Let's see, you know, what are, you know, oh, maybe it'll happen this time and I'll get out of here. They're going to whip me again. Great. You know, I mean, you know, it was, I don't have that perspective. I hate to disappoint you. But it seems, you know, that God takes us into those things, you see, because it's when it's in our weakness that his strength is realized. As long as we have our own resource, as long as we're left within the boundaries of our own capabilities, we're not looking up. The draw on is. What he's saying is God finds it necessary because he knows we need to learn certain things about him. He takes us to the place where we run out of gas, where our own tank is empty, beyond our own resources, and there's where we begin to see things about God that we never would have seen if we were left to ourselves. I mean, it's when God takes his people to the Red Sea with the Egyptians barking up their heels and with Edward G. Robinson saying, well, Moses, where's your God now? You know, I mean, he puts us in those places so we can see that, behold the glory of God, so we can see the sea part. He's got to put us somewhere where there is no possible way of escape that we could do. Because if we could get out of there, we'd just punch Edward G. Robinson and get out. You understand? He has to take us to the place where there's no possible way of escape so that we might learn some new thing about him. He's got to take us into the wilderness where we're saying, hey, you brought us out here to starve, didn't you, Moses? You know, so that we can see manna fall from heaven. And he says that in Deuteronomy 8. I took your fathers, I led them in such a way, and I humbled them and fed them with manna from heaven that their fathers didn't know about, so they might learn that that man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. What he says is I had to take them to a place, into an experience that their fathers knew nothing about. I wanted to take them on further than anything they had learned or heard about from past generations. I wanted to reveal something new about myself that they would never have seen. And when I read this passage, you know what? It's a hard pill for me to swallow personally in some ways. And yet, I think what, you know, Paul didn't tell us what he saw in heaven. He didn't tell us what God told him there. Paul's telling us what God said to him back on earth. So evidently, at least that is for us. What he heard in heaven isn't for us today. What he heard on earth is. And I'm sure he had people around him saying, Paul, don't worry. You know, this story, you're suffering now, but someday you'll be in heaven. He probably said, that's why do you think I was there already? You know what I mean? What do you mean? You know. I think the message in it today is for all of us. I mean, I would never want my kids to think, you know, your dad is doing this to you because he's getting you. You know, you have not cleaned your room again and that's it. That's why this is coming in your life. Your dad is sick and tired of you. This is it. This was the straw that broke the camel's back. That's why the chastening rod is coming down on you. Your father doesn't love you. He doesn't care about you. I would be awfully angry to hear somebody tell my kids that. And I think probably the greatest concern in the heart of God as we read through a passage like this is whatever painful or if only situation we might be in, whatever that is and however that's interpreted in your life, you're never forsaken. That's what this is saying to me. That in fact, it's orchestrated. You know, the thorn has been given. It didn't hunt you down and jump on you. The messenger has been given. The denial of our prayers for deliverance is a gift that has been given. And that over a period of time, some point in hindsight, we realize, now I see, Lord, why you let this happen. Now I understand it. And hopefully we haven't spoken too foolishly along the way. And I think, personally, how God as a father must be angered when he hears another man say, well, it's because you lack faith. God is doing this to you because there's sin in your life, and how a poor soul searches over his heart to say, what have I done? Where have I sinned? Where have I blown it? You know, if I could only touch the magic thing and ask for forgiveness for the right sin, all of this would be lifted. No, there are times when what we're going through, it's not chastening, it's not sin, it's very prescribed, and it's preventative. It will teach us and keep us and make us ultimately what God wants us to be. And I think the Lord, along the way, his heart is that we wouldn't lose sight of that, that we wouldn't misinterpret him and his concern and his love and his plan for us by the painful circumstances that we might be going through. And you know what? That's hard, because you see, I haven't come to the place where I said, oh, great, another trial. This is great. Boy, God's going to show me something neat in this, you know. Oh, man, cancer. Woo, I can, you know, this is going to be great. When I get to witness to doctors, I'll get to do this, you know. You know, I haven't come to the point where Paul, because Paul had been there already, he couldn't do anything to bother him. What are you going to do, kill me? I can't wait. Yet if we want those kind of revelations, there's a cost involved. And I think along the way, in all of our lives, God is heading us to the same place. God is taking us, conforming us into the image and likeness of his Son, just like he was doing with Paul, at a different speed, at a different meter, depending on our personality, depending on what we can bear. His grace is always sufficient for us wherever we are, whatever your pain is today. And I think the lie that can enter into the picture is that somehow you've been excluded from God's love and God's plan for your life and his care and his concern. And I think it's blasphemous to promote that. I think I would not want to be in those shoes when they give account for God for enforcing that kind of nonsense on God's people. Because it's hard enough for us as we're going through it to look up and say, okay, Lord, you know, you've brought me here to teach me, to refine me, to keep me. It's hard enough that I have to eat string beans when I want to eat chocolate chips. Without someone saying, your dad's a meanie, that's why he makes you eat string beans. Let's stand and let's pray.